Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we mark Veterans Week with a very special program featuring an extended interview with Chester Nez, the last of the Navajo Code Talkers, whose Native American language produced a code that couldn't be broken by the Japanese, a code that helped win World War II in the Pacific. Chester Nez is 92 years old, a man who served on the front lines of Guadalcanal, Guam, Bougainville, and other islands in the Pacific. He grew up near the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico. In a tribe that suffered greatly at the hands of the American military in the 1800s, and again in the New Deal of the 1930s. He was told to never speak his language when they tried to erase his culture in government boarding school. Ironically, the government would later use that same language to help win the war in the Pacific. You'll also hear from Judith Sheese Avila, who helped Mr. Nez with his autobiography, Code Talker. You'll hear from his grandson, Latham. And then we'll hear analysis from World War II veteran Walter John Chilson, a former state senator and member of the Wisconsin Broadcasters Hall of Fame, and from Jim Campbell, the co-director of the Honor Flight Program, which brings World War II veterans to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. Chester Nez drew thousands of people to his appearances this week in Wausau and Edgar, appearances made possible by the Edgar School District Lecture Series, A Walk in Their Shoes. More than 800 people spilled out of the main auditorium at UW Marathon County in Wausau, forcing the school to open three overflow rooms, all to see a 92-year-old American Indian, Chester Nez.
28 Navajo Code Talkers in World War II. I was very happy to be selected to be one of the members, to be able to serve our country and come home alive.
Chester Nez is the last of the Code Talkers, whose ancient Navajo language was undecipherable to the Japanese. He came to central Wisconsin with the woman who helped him write his autobiography, Judith Sheath Avila.
The history books that were written in the flush of victory after the war, none of them knew anything about the Code Talkers. So the Code Talkers really didn't get recognized.
Chester Nez grew up near the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico. His tribe suffered greatly. Avila says hundreds were killed in the American military's Long Walk in the 1800s.
Chester's great-grandmother was on the Long Walk. She was 13 years old. She made it through, but many of the women did not.
In the 1920s, Chester Nez was sent to boarding school, where the American government punished him for speaking his native language. So it came as a surprise when he was recruited by the Marines to use that same language, the language they tried to destroy, to help win the war.
There's something else that bothers me. They try to make us talk English all the time.
Chester Nez became a Marine and fought on the front lines of Guadalcanal. The coded messages he sent saved many lives, but Nez wishes he could have saved more.
A real terrible story that I had to go through. And I'm sorry to say that our own people, our own soldiers, gave their life.
Hundreds stood in line to meet the Code Talker. For Patrick Bradley of Wausau, it was personal. Bradley's father, John, helped raise the flag in the iconic picture of Iwo Jima.
I just learned a couple weeks ago that the communication from one of the battleships at Iwo Jima to the main island directing that a larger second flag be raised was given in the Navajo Code.
Melody Campbell is a member of the Chippewa tribe of Bay Mills, Michigan. She says her family can relate to Chester Nez's experience in boarding school.
I had a grandmother, and she was sent to the boarding schools as well, and she never spoke a lick of her native tongue until probably about 6 months before she passed. She started speaking it again.
Alan Caldwell of Gresham served in the Army in the late 60s. He's a retired history teacher and a member of Wisconsin's Menominee tribe.
Oh, we have almost 180 tribal members that served during Vietnam. 80% of us volunteered.
And why is that, with the way the Native Americans have been treated?
Back in the 1800s, when our grandfathers signed those treaties, a lot of those treaties contained a loyalty oath that said, as Native people, we would come to the aid of the country in a time of distress. So as honorable people, we are honoring and upholding the words of our grandfathers.
And for 92-year-old Chester Nez, it's still all about honor.
I think that being a Marine is one of the best things that ever happened to me. I really enjoyed being a Marine and served my country.
This week, Chester Nez received the Audie Murphy Award at the American Veterans Center. He was given the Congressional Gold Medal in 2001 by President George W. Bush. In Wausau, I'm Glenn Mulbert for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Now, the day after Chester Nez made that appearance on Veterans Day, we had a chance to sit down with him and with Judith Sheath Avila, who helped him with his autobiography, Code Talker, the first and only memoir by one of the original Navajo Code Talkers of World War II. They were joined by Chester's grandson, Latham Nez, and they had just returned from Washington, D.C., where Chester Nez was presented with that Audie Murphy Award at the American Veterans Center.
Well, it was really an honor. Audie Murphy was the most decorated soldier in World War II, and for someone to be given an award named after Audie Murphy is a tremendous honor. We even had Senator Kerry from Nebraska at our table. It was a fascinating event and really an exciting event.
And Chester also received the Congressional Gold Medal several years ago from President George W. Bush.
Yes, it was in 2001. And that gold medal was given to the original 29 Navajo Code Talkers. Unfortunately, only four of them were healthy enough to attend. There was a fifth still alive, but in the hospital.
Chester, your experience, what do you remember about getting the gold medal from President Bush?
I think the award was very interesting, and I thought it was one of the best things that ever happened to me.
And Chester, you've had an opportunity to meet and tell your story to young people in Edgar and Wausau last night. What has their reaction been like?
The reaction to my story was very interesting to a lot of people that came out to see me and to hear what I had to say. I am very happy to be here and talk about some of the experience I had during World War II.
Well, let's talk about some of that. Did you ever think, when you were a young boy growing up outside the Navajo Reservation in the checkerboard area of New Mexico, did you ever think that someday hundreds of people would turn out to hear your story?
Well, I never thought about those things until I came around to tell my story. I am very proud and very happy to do this.
We understand that your grandson, Latham, also made the trip out from Albuquerque for the events here. He must be very proud of his grandfather.
Yes, I'm very, very proud of him, Mr.
Latham, do you want to lean over into the microphone and tell me how proud you are of your grandfather?
I am extremely, extremely proud of my grandfather. What my grandfather has done has definitely lightened my life and made me really see what a good person truly is, and I can only strive to be a fraction of what he was, and I really do look up and love this man. Thank you.
And what do you think of the heroism that he showed during World War II, fighting on the front lines of Guadalcanal, Latham?
Wow, that I'm speechless when it comes to that. I mean, to know that my grandfather endured that for his country and protect his people and the land and you know, our way of life is priceless and just I adore the man.
Judith, why does the story of Chester Nez resonate with so many people?
I think it's because Chester is very approachable, very much an ordinary person, and not at all conceited about what he did, and yet what he did was so huge. It really helped us to win the war. And I think also the fact that it was secret for so long resonates with people.
And it was secret even after they came back. It wasn't until, 1968 that he was able to share his story with his friends and family and other people?
1968, 23 years after the war ended. That's a long time to keep a secret. And because of this, the history books that were written in the flush of victory after the war, none of them knew anything about the Code Talkers. So the Code Talkers really didn't get recognized until very late.
Chester, you are the last of the 29 original Code Talkers. Can you tell us what the first message was that you transmitted in World War II? Mm-hmm. And if you could, say it in the Navajo language and then say it for us in English.
Spending my time on Guadalcanal, my first landing, it was a message that came in. Japanese machine gun that's on your right flank, destroy. And in a code, this is what it sounds like. Not a cut.
Now, you were right in the front lines of that fight. There were bullets flying all around. Tell us about that.
This is something that is very interesting and very scary. I have seen a lot of casualties, and the enemy came at us with everything they had and their power, and they tried to wrap us out. We blew them up off the island, and that was something very important.
Now, when you landed on the island, according to the book, you had to wade into shore through dozens, maybe hundreds of dead soldiers floating in the water with bullets whizzing all around you and bombs exploding. Do you still remember that?
This is very true. When I came ashore, there was bullet flying and hand grenades and artillery, and everything was all over. But one of the most scary things in my life to go through something like that. But I was very lucky to come ashore alive and did not drop over the troops.
Now, we understand that with the Navajo religion, you're supposed to avoid contact with the dead, but you were surrounded by dead and dying people. How were you able to do your mission with all of those dead and dying people around when it was a problem with your religion?
This is something that is very important to our people, you know, to have a lot of respect, you know, to dying people and everything like that. And that was something that I'll never forget. It's a real terrible story that I had to go through. And I'm sorry to say that a lot of these our own people, our own soldiers, gave their life.
Now, you arrived on shore, and you dug a trench to operate a handheld radio with your friend Ray, another Navajo code talker. I'm going to read to you a couple of paragraphs now from Judith's book, what you said in her book that she helped you write. I spoke in Navajo while Roy cranked, enemy machine gun nest on your right flank, destroy. Suddenly, just after my message was received, the Japanese guns exploded, destroyed by U.S. artillery. I shouted, "Did you see that?" "Sure did," Roy grinned. Roy and I ran and crawled to a new position, knowing the Japanese were experts at targeting the locations from which messages had been sent. We never stayed on the radio a second longer than we had to. Immediately, we focused on sending the next message, moving, then sending the next. Bullets zipping around us kept the level of noise high, but we heard the Navajo words in spite of the war exploding around us. Artillery shells whistled past us. I dived, the radio under me. We never stopped transmitting. More than 24 hours passed before we were able to grab a few hours of sleep. We woke, still exhausted, in the hole that we dug 2 days before. Chester, you must have thought you were going to die.
This is something that's very, very important. When you go into battle, you start thinking about whether you're going to come out alive or you're going to be killed. I was very, very afraid about not coming home from the war, but I was pretty lucky to come home.
What was it like fighting the Japanese who were trained not to surrender, but to fight to the death, the Banzai fighters?
It was very, very, very scary thing to go through. Some of the items that we took back from the Japanese. I was very, very lucky to come through the battle.
You carried a medicine bag into war with personal items and sacred corn pollen. Tell us about the corn pollen that you carried.
The corn pollen is something that leads us in the right direction and gives us safety and everything like that. I carried a small sack of corn pollen with me all through the war, and that really helped me out. a lot of our older people that went through different wars saved us. This is something that I really respect.
Now, Judith, these medicine bags were very important to the Navajo.
Yes. They were sent from home. The corn pollen had been blessed, and the men knew that their families were praying for them. As a matter of fact, many of the Navajo men could hear the sheep bells, usually around noon, and the sheep bells meant that they were being prayed for and watched over.
I read that in the autobiography, and it's a very startling part of the book. Here they are in Guadalcanal, halfway around the world from home, and they can hear the sheep bells because that's the sound that they heard in their own minds when their friends and family back home were saying prayers for them.
Exactly. Yeah, I thought it was really kind of wonderful, and it gave them a great deal of comfort knowing they were being prayed for.
And they had to fight harder than just about anyone else on Guadalcanal because, as code talkers, their mission was so important. They weren't allowed to take leave with
That's
the other
right.
soldiers when they went to Australia because they had to stay for the next group of soldiers coming in so they could transmit the Navajo codes.
You're right. It was pretty incredible, the stamina of those first code talkers. They were the only ones out there in the Pacific, those first 27 men, because two stayed home to train new recruits. But every time the Marine Division they were with went to rest and recuperation, they got switched to another division. So they really stayed in battle or surrounding the battled islands all the way through the war.
How long would it take to decipher a message transmitted between Navajo soldiers using the Navajo code compared to the old shackle code, the old code that was used before?
That was pretty impressive. When they first got to Guadalcanal, the communications officer they reported to did a test because he doubted that their code was going to be any good to him. And when he tested them, a series of messages he gave to his men that he figured would take 4 hours to transmit and receive a response, the Navajo code talkers did it in 2.5 minutes. So it was pretty much real time. As someone spoke or as they read a message in English, they'd translate it into Navajo and then get an immediate response from the other side.
And logistically, that's so important because in the middle of a battle, you can't wait 4 hours to find out where the enemy is and where you have to send the bombs and where danger might be coming toward you.
That's absolutely right, Glenn, yes.
Why was the Navajo language so effective in the code so that even the Japanese couldn't break it?
Part of it was because Navajo's not written, so no one could learn it from a book. Another piece of it was that hardly anyone in the whole world spoke Navajo unless they lived on the Navajo reservation. And the third thing was the Navajo language was extremely complex, using all kinds of sounds that other languages don't use. And so they were hard to even discern if you hadn't been raised with those sounds.
And they have words that can change their meanings based on the tone of voice used.
Exactly. It is really complex. Some people say it's the most complicated language in the world.
And just transmitting messages with that language would probably have been sufficient, but they actually created a code based on it by using Navajo words to symbolize letters in the English alphabet. Tell us about
yes.
that.
Well, first, the reason they needed it to be a code was because should the Japanese capture a Navajo who was not a code talker, if they just spoke in Navajo, then they would have been the non-code talkers could have cracked the messages and told the Japanese what they were. As it happened, the Japanese did capture Navajos, but they were never able to tell what the messages were because they were in code.
And they had to, the Navajos themselves, after creating this code, they had to really work hard to memorize it so that they had everything down.
Yes, yes, they did. They worked and worked and worked until they were almost like machines. They didn't have to stop and think. And they created an alphabet that depended upon English and Navajo. For instance, A was the English word ant, but they translated that to Navajo, Wolachi. So when they said Wolachi, that meant A. And they also had many words for items that they didn't want to have to spell out because they were going to use certain terms a lot, like fighter aircraft or destroyers or tanks and so on. And they used Navajo words that made sense. Turtle for a tank, hummingbird for fighters, shark for a destroyer, eggs for bombs, yes.
Now, the ironic thing here is that Chester and the other Navajo Indians were told when he was young that he had to stop speaking the Navajo language. The government tried to wipe out the language by forcing Chester and the other Navajos to attend English-only boarding schools.
They did, and they were severely punished if they were caught speaking Navajo. They were kicked or hit or had their teeth brushed with Fels naphtha soap.
That's very true. When we get caught, they take us and they wash our mouth with soap and water, and they spank us and stuff like that. So there you go, just think back at how these things happened to us.
How did you feel as a boy to be taken away from your family and put in a school where they were trying to take away your language and your culture and your religion?
There's something else that bothers me through my days of night when they used to get after us for speaking our own language, and they tried to make us talk English all the time.
Did it come as a surprise to you then when the Marines told you they needed your language, your ancient Navajo language, to help win the war, and they actually recruited people who could still speak the language? After they tried to get you to stop speaking it, they told you they wanted to speak it.
That's a very funny story. I often think about these things, what we went through and everything like that, you know. It's a very, very important to us that we use our language to transmit messages against the Japanese. The Japanese tried everything in their power to break the code, but they never did.
Now, the Navajo tribe, your people, were also mistreated by the early white settlers. There were even episodes of genocide where hundreds were killed. It's in your oral traditions. In The Long Walk back in the 1880s, and again I'm going to read from your book, "Soldiers pulled our ancestors from their land. A famous white man, Kit Carson, burned Navajo crops, uprooted our trees, killed our livestock, and warned all Navajos to surrender. They were forced to march 350 miles from Fort Defiance to Fort Sumter in New Mexico. The walk took 20 days, and along the way, hundreds died. If someone got sick, they were killed by the soldiers. If a pregnant woman stopped to have her baby, she was killed. Anyone who tried to help her was also killed. If someone collapsed from thirst or hunger, he was killed." Chester Nez, did those things really happen?
That is a very, very true story that you just read.
And Judith, in World War II, we fought against the Japanese who killed our soldiers in the Philippines in the brutal Bataan Death March, The Long Walk. Now, it sounds like that was another death march, but one that Native Americans were forced to walk.
That's true. You really could draw a parallel there. And Chester's great-grandmother was on the Long Walk. She was 13 years old. And she was young and healthy, and she made it through. But many of the women did not, especially the pregnant women, and many of the men did not. And once they got to Fort Sumner, there was no housing and no food. So it was a very poorly planned relocation.
And then in the 1930s, under the New Deal, there was an effort to stabilize livestock prices and stop the overgrazing that helped create the Dust Bowl. And another terrible thing was forced upon the Navajo tribe, again by the American government, the wholesale slaughter of their livestock and their sheep and goat herds.
Yes, yes. The government had the Bureau of Indian Affairs employees come onto the reservation and the checkerboard, and everywhere where people had over 100 head of livestock, they dug huge trenches on their land and had them herd about two-thirds, more than two-thirds, really, of their livestock into the trench. Then they sealed the trench off and sprinkled the animals with coal oil and set them on fire. Chester's grandmother had 1,000 sheep, and 700 of them were burned. They totally destroyed the Navajo economy, really, is what happened.
Chester, you were a young boy when that happened. Do you remember the animals being burned?
Yes, I surely do remember when they came in and started killing the sheep off and everything like that. I was so unhappy to see something like that. And it was a terrible thing that ever happened to us.
And as an Indian, you have a spiritual connection to your animals.
That's very true. It's something that when we grew up, baby lambs and everything that we have, I was so happy to see a lot of our sheep that was saved. But over 1,000 sheep were also been destroyed, and it's a terrible thing to see something like that.
And then, even so, with this history of terrible things done to your people by the American government, you still volunteered to serve in the American Armed Forces, to be a Marine, and you fought on the front lines in World War II. Why did you volunteer to help the American government after all the terrible things the American government had done to your people?
I don't know. It's just something that I thought it was something that's going to be very good to serve our country. That's why I joined the Marine Corps as a co-talker.
So even with all of the terrible things that happened, you thought it was more important to serve your country?
That's very true.
And Judith, the Navajo made very good soldiers.
Yes, the Marines loved their Navajo recruits. They were kind of famous when they went through Marine basic training because they did so well. And the Marines treated them as equals. When you're a Marine, if you're a good Marine, that's all that matters, not whether your skin is brown or red or white or purple.
And after the war, a Japanese paper, the Fuji Evening, said, this is a quote from the paper, if the Japanese Imperial Intelligence Team could have decoded the Navajo messages, the history of the Pacific War might have turned out completely differently.
Yes, and now that it's been released from secrecy, many historians agree with the Fuji Evening Herald. That was a huge statement for the Japanese to make, I think, because what they were doing in kind of a subtle way was admitting defeat because they couldn't translate the messages, and they were giving the Navajo men credit.
And then, because that code was top secret until 1968, Chester Nez and the other Navajo came home. They didn't have ticker tape parades. They had to keep their secret even from their friends and family. No recognition, and they couldn't even vote when they came home to New Mexico.
I know, it was really pretty awful. And many of the young men who had been so well accepted by the Marines thought they would step into mainstream society and be accepted there, as they should have been. But they weren't, and they couldn't find jobs. And when they were interviewed, they couldn't tell the person interviewing them about what they'd already accomplished in designing and executing a wonderful code that helped the U.S. win the war. They just had to keep their mouths shut, and many of the young men died within a few years of returning from war.
Chester, how did your service in the Marines in the South Pacific change you as a man?
I think being a Marine is one of the best things that ever happened to me. It has changed a lot of my way of living, and I really enjoyed being a Marine and serving my country. I'm very happy about that.
Would you do it all over again?
If I was called back and do it all over again, I think it would be something to believe in that true story.
Can you say a prayer for our soldiers in the Navajo language?
During World War II on Guadalcanal, we used to have a little session about praying. Being a man with a prayer is something that's very important to us Navajos. We try to say our prayers in the morning, in the evening, and this is one of my prayers. From morning till night, we will stay alive and do what we can to save other people's lives too.
And can you say that in Navajo for me? Chester Nez, Judith Avila, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Glenn, for having us on your show.
And Chester, thank you so much for your service.
Thank you very much.
I'm Glenn Moberg. If you just joined us, you're listening to a special Veterans Week edition of Route 51 Regional Talk Radio featuring an interview with 92-year-old Chester Nez, last of the Navajo Code Talkers, and the woman who helped him with his autobiography, Judith Sheese Avila. And when we come back, we'll have analysis from World War II veteran and Hall of Fame broadcaster Walter John Chilson and Jim Campbell of the Honor Flight Program. I'm Glenn Moberg. If you joined us just now, you're listening to a special Veterans Week edition of Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We just heard a lengthy interview with 92-year-old Chester Nez, the last of the Navajo Code Talkers, and also Judith Sheese Avila, who helped him with his autobiography, an autobiography entitled Code Talker, the first and only memoir by one of the original Navajo Code Talkers of World War II. We're joined now for analysis by Walter John Chilson, former state senator, member of the Wisconsin Broadcasters Hall of Fame, and a World War II veteran who fought in the Pacific Theater, and also by Jim Campbell. He's a co-director of the Wausau Area Honor Flight Program, which has brought hundreds of World War II veterans to view their memorial in Washington, D.C. We want to hear from you as well. We'd like to hear your comments. What do you think of Chester Nez's story? Were you one of the hundreds upon hundreds of people, well over 1,000, who attended his appearances this week in Edgar and Wausau? Maybe you fought in World War II, or you've got a relative or friend who did. Please give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. Our lines are open, wide open right now, and that phone number is 1-800-780-9742. And again, that's 1-800-780-9742. Walter John, you fought in the Pacific Theater in World War II on some of those islands where Chester Nez fought. What do you think of his story?
Oh, that's just a fabulous story. What an interesting man he is, and so articulate as well. By the way, the fellow who was doing the interview, Glenn Moberg, did an outstanding job as well.
That is very high praise coming from a Hall of Fame broadcaster, Mr. Chilson. Jim Campbell, you saw Chester Nez at his appearance in Wausau. What's your reaction?
Incredible. As I was sitting in the audience listening to him, three things became paramount in my mind. Number one, my father, a World War II Marine in the South Pacific, who did not live long enough to see his memorials, fought on many of the same islands that Chester and the Code Talkers worked. And I wonder, you know, is it possible that he had an effect on my father living through those incredible battles? Number two, the comments that were made that even though he was treated as a Native American, totally different in his home as a Marine, regardless of color of skin, regardless of religious background, regardless of any of those things, the same as it is today and when I served, there was no color. And it didn't matter if you prayed in a mosque or a church or didn't at all, you were a Marine. And in my generation, obviously, the color of your skin made a big difference when you were just a civilian. So that parallel is very similar regardless of generation as a Marine, and I'm sure in other branches of service as well. And the third, I kept thinking about a veteran that went on our very first flight, a local World War II veteran who fought in that horrendous battle on Guadalcanal, the first time that Chester used his code and Reine Gotis made it through the South Pacific. So those three things immediately were the first three things I thought about.
As well as he also mentioned their dedication to help the United States, even after the abysmal treatment that the Navajo had been visited on them by the soldiers, American soldiers, and the American government. And still, they kept their part of the treaty and was a pledge to help out the United States whenever they needed help. I thought that was very significant.
And what I wasn't aware of until I started doing research for this program and his appearance was that this wasn't just in the 1800s. What happened during the New Deal, where they slaughtered the livestock and destroyed their economy, was pretty horrific too. Yet right after that, that's when he signed up to join the Marines.
Yeah.
You know, the long walk, that's something that happened to his grandmother.
Yeah.
But the livestock, that's something that he saw himself, yeah. And it still didn't affect his patriotism.
Yeah, awesome.
Jim, why do you think it's so important to tell the stories of these World War II veterans, because we're losing so many of them every day?
Yeah, tomorrow we'll have 640 less. We'll have, in the 12 counties that we serve with the Honor Flight, we'll lose one per day per county. And quite frankly, like many of us who had fathers that served during that time frame of World War II, they never said anything. They never said a word. And I don't want to put all the onus on the veteran, because how many of their children and grandchildren said, "Hey, what happened? You know, what'd you do?" And asked for the stories. The one benefit that we found out that I guess we really didn't even think about 4 years ago and 3 days ago when we started on Veterans Day, is that after that experience, after bonding with 100 other veterans of your generation, many started talking. First they started talking amongst themselves, then they started telling the stories to their families. We've had guardians that are family members that during the trip, dad or grandpa told them a story they had never heard before. And this history is leaving us at a high rate of speed, and they're not writing it down. So like the Navajo's language, if they tell their children and their grandchildren, the story will be captured and hopefully passed on generation to generation.
Is that true, Walter John? A lot of the World War II vets had trouble sharing their stories. And I'm speaking from personal experience. My father fought in World War II in the European theater. Never talked about it. Just never talked about it to the family.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of truth. I think the one of the most significant ones I know about is John Bradley, who was one of the flag raisers on Iwo Jima from Antigo, and he didn't want to talk to his children about being a hero, the hero that he was. And yet, when you read the book, you understand what a tremendous job he did in fighting the enemy and protecting his own troops as well, and constantly putting his life at risk. And but when he got home, he didn't want to talk about being a hero. He said the heroes were those who died on Iwo Jima. And you can accept that, you know, but still you feel that he should have been taking some credit as well. I'm bragging about it a little bit.
Well, Jim, we heard from his son, Patrick Bradley, in that piece at the beginning of the show, and Patrick told the story about Iwo Jima, that the decision to raise that large flag on the top of the mountain, the one that his father, John, was holding up,
that's right.
That was transmitted in Navajo.
That's exactly right. Colonel Johnson, when he saw the small flag go up, the first flag raising, he could barely see it on top of Mount Suribachi. And he dispatched a couple of runners, a couple of which were the second flag raisers, and said, "I want every blankety-blank Marine and sailor to be able to see this flag to let them know that we're on top of Mount Suribachi." The outcropping from that created a mass of screaming and hollering and shooting of guns, because a lot of the folks on the ships thought the island was captured. It's all over. 4 days into it, they thought it was all over, when in fact it had just started and went for another 30 days.
All that
communication from the top of Suribachi to the ship was done with Navajo code talkers.
And the millions of people back in the United States thought that we had had victory on Iwo Jima at that time too. And yet, hundreds, thousands of soldiers died, Marines died after that.
Walter John, you served in the Pacific Theater in World War II. You were on bombing runs over Iwo Jima. Can you tell us a story about that?
Yeah, that's my connection to Iwo, and I'm proud of having been able to help him a little bit, but I think the bombs that we dropped really didn't do a lot of damage because the Japanese were so firmly entrenched underground. I think on about our 11th mission, I was a bombardier on a B-24, and we were dropping fragment bombs at that time. They exploded like a hand grenade, anti-personnel bombs, and we thought we'd get some of the Japanese soldiers on the ground that way, but probably was, in final analysis, quite ineffective. But on our bombing run, just as I released the bombs, we think that flak, anti-aircraft flak, hit our bombs and exploded right beneath our plane. And we went flying up into the air, whoosh, you know, and then after that started to spiral down toward the ocean. The pilot said, all crew members prepare to bail out. And I thought, I was afraid of bailing out any place over, okay, even over our own island, but to bail out at that place would sure have been a fatality. But anyway, the co-pilot, wow, co-pilot leveled the plane out a little bit, and we made it back to Saipan. But coming in on the final run, we used a toggle switch to bring the flaps down. Only one flap came down, causing us to peel off, and we crashed into the water. There was 11 members aboard. 8 of us survived, and most of us don't even realize how we got out of the plane.
What do you remember about that? Here you're in a situation where the plane is down, it's in the water. 3 people ended up dying on that plane. Yeah, yeah. You made it out somehow. What happened?
Well, I was lucky enough to come to the surface. I thought I'd never get to the surface. I may have been knocked out. I had a slight head injury. May have been knocked out at the impact. But I came to deep in the water, came up, and there was a life raft not far away. And I swam to it, and unfortunately it was upside down. We'd been taught how to turn them over, but I thought, to heck with it, I'll just hang on to it. And I paddled around and picked up other crew members who didn't have life vests, and either, nor did I. And they were prepared for the possibility that if we parachuted out, we might have blown off into the water. So there were PT boats and other, mm-hmm, Navy crew around, and they came very quickly to pick up the survivors.
You know, and experiences like that aren't that uncommon among World War II veterans. A guy who also served in the Pacific and who you worked with at Channel 7 when you came back stateside, Dick Dudley, was floating in shark-infested water for, 48 hours? Some incredible length of time?
I think so, yeah. He didn't even have a life. I guess they had a life raft that they cruised around in, but they weren't picked up for a couple of days. That's when ship that he was on was shot out from under them.
How important were coded messages in World War II? And I know that's just a really obvious question, but I'd like you to talk about it.
Well, I all of a sudden realized it was going on, when it was going on. To learn about it now is extremely fascinating. Who knows what other good things happened besides just the relaying of the second flag going up on Iwo Jima. I'm sure there was a lot of other messaging going on as well. The great tragedy about events like Lake Iwo and Guadalcanal, as Mr. Nez had related, a lot of these invaders, our troops invading, were killed before they even got ashore. There was a tremendous number of fatalities on Iwo as well before they were able to get ashore. I think that's one of the great tragedies. I don't know much about what kind of messages were related to Glenn, but I'm sure many of them did help save lives.
And it's those radio guys who had to be among the first to get on shore. If you read Chester Nez's book, Code Talker, he describes in detail waiting on shore and having the bodies floating around him and the bombs exploding and the bullets whizzing. He was one of the first people.
And the radio men in all conflicts, in World War II, if you look closely at the statue of the radio man at the Korean Memorial, you can actually, in the statue's eyes, see the fear, the absolute fear in their eyes, because the radio guys were one of the first to be targeted in any conflict, because they're the ones that communicate the information from the generals and so forth to the front line. So they go first.
And the enemy knew that was going on, therefore they targeted those.
Absolutely.
Comment on the irony of the U.S. government trying to wipe out the Navajo language, punishing Chester Nez for speaking it, washing his mouth out with lye soap, and then recruiting him and using that language that they tried to destroy as the basis for the code that helped them win the war.
That's great irony. Just amazing.
And Chester accepted it with a sense of humor, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, he did. Yeah. It's amazing that that the Navajo just didn't tell the U.S. government to go pound sand, quite frankly. Their character is a people's.
I think it was really significant as well, Glenn, when you phrased that question that way and pointed out the irony to him. I don't think he'd even thought about it before that, because that's the way he chuckled, like, never thought about that before.
That's right.
At 4 hours to send a message with the old shackle code and just 2 minutes to transmit it between the Navajo code talkers.
Unbelievable. And we saw in the presentation the Navajo language on the screen. And the word for ant was about 12 letters long. So how could they
just
do...
Just the letter A.
Just for the letter A. And that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing.
Now, you know, we're talking about why Native Americans serve to the extent that they did. And in that piece at the start of the program, we heard from the member of the Menominee tribe, that Native American historian, who said that their grandfather's grandfathers, those were his words, signed the treaties with the U.S., and there was a loyalty oath saying that they would help the U.S. government during times of duress. So they volunteered and fought in the armed forces in part to honor their grandfather's words.
Unbelievable.
It's such integrity is really so laudable, and I'm glad it's coming out now, because we didn't know about it before
Didn't know about it.
And young Latham, you know, the admiration he had for his grandfather was so evident, and it makes you wish that kind of respect for elders existed across the entire population, not just in Native American tribes.
Right. And that's a good time for me to pay a compliment to my colleague here, what a fantastic job you're doing with the honor flights. I went on an honor flight. I think you were on. You went with me on.
I did.
I think so. And it was just such a tremendous experience, and a great tribute to the rapidly disappearing veterans of World War II. And I compliment you highly, and I personally I enjoyed it tremendously, and I know thousands of others are doing the same.
I could tell that day the smile on your face was very evident.
Yeah.
And what he didn't say is it took me 3 years to convince him to go. And I asked him all through the day, are you glad you came?
Yeah.
Now, you have another friend in the industry.
Yeah, Mark Zelich.
Mark Zelich.
Mark has not signed up yet.
Oh, no. We're going to have to work on Mark.
He's being very modest.
Yes.
Being very modest, saying, no, I didn't earn it. He said, I guess he didn't go overseas at all.
Doesn't matter.
But I think as we pay tribute to veterans this week, I want to pay a tribute as well to my colleagues. I was lucky, but I didn't have to face the kind of hand-to-hand combat that Marines did on Iwo, or people did in Europe in the invasion there. Tremendous effort, and commendable.
And Jim Campbell, if people want to find out more about the Honor Flight program, where can they go?
Well, a number of places. Website with our name, neverforgottenhonorflight.org or .com. We have a Facebook page, and all the contact information is available. If you're interested in signing up as a guardian to escort an honored veteran, or if you're a veteran and would like to sign up to go on a future flight.
We want to thank our many guests on today's show. First and foremost, 92-year-old Chester Nez, last of the original Navajo Code Talkers, Mr. Nez's grandson, Latham Nez, Judith Sheese Avila, who worked on his autobiography, Code Talker. Also World War II veteran, former state senator and Hall of Fame broadcaster Walter John Chilson, and Jim Campbell, co-director of the Wausau Area Honor Flight Program. Thanks to the Edgar School District's A Walk in Their Shoes program and history teacher Colin Hansen for bringing Chester Nez to Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. And thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Peter Phippen and the U.S. Marine Band. Next week on Route 51, we look at the importance of family sitting down and having dinner together. An effort to foster family togetherness by sharing food. Remember to follow us on Facebook. You can hear this program rebroadcast in its entirety this Friday evening at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. Until next week, we're heading out of town.